Welcome to the Peter Moon Podcast, brought to you by Sky Books and the music of Lusa.
Peter, we've talked about the negative sides of remote viewing, and I was wondering if there are any, if there's any advice you can give to our listeners as far as good practices to remote viewing, and anywhere, any steps that they can take in preparing themselves to start remote viewing.
Well, yes, and we can address this in some form of detail. A lot of what we've been discussing in the past is centered around the circumstances and politics of remote viewing as I came to be involved with the subject via the subject of Scientology and L. Ron Hubbard. So I have evolved since my involvement with them, and I evolved into Taoist Qigong, which I study weekly in Brooklyn with Grandmaster Roosevelt Ganey. And one of the most beneficial techniques I've learned is called the dark room. And I discuss this in detail in my book, latest book, The White Bat, The Alchemy of Writing. And what remote viewing has to do with is stimulating the visual cortex. You have a visual cortex which breaks down into two sides. The left stimulates the right stimulates the left, and the retina is an input into the visual cortex. There are other inputs, and you see this in the state of dreams. Your visual cortex is part of your brain. So there would be the potential for holographic interpretation inside the brain. Not more than the potential, the actuality. Because when you go into a dream, you're seeing things holographically. You're seeing virtual reality. And we're going to go back to the subject of holography and its impact upon everything. And some of the things we've discussed in the three previous podcasts on remote viewing. We can go back to this subject. I'm just going to recommend a book at this point because what I want to deal with, and I don't know how long this is going to take, but the fact is it goes into some interesting and intriguing areas. And this concerns the politics and moral climate of the surrounding circumstances with regard to the politics of not only remote viewing, but once again, the subjects surrounding it. And this has to do with, once again, fortunately or unfortunately, the subject of Scientology, which I cannot unwrap myself from if I want to maintain the integrity of my own consciousness on these matters. Okay. And not just because I was involved in it, because of the circumstances surrounding the founder of it.
Right.
And there's an occult matrix underneath Scientology. And there's an occult matrix under everything, including our government. Now, what I'm responding to has been prompted by the response I've gotten to the podcasts thus far. And because we vowed to make this an organic experience, I want to integrate what has been organically encountered. Now, most of the responses are very positive towards me or whatever. Hey, this is intriguing. Carry on.
Right.
Some of the responses are a little incoherent, whereas why did you say this? And I'll say, well, I didn't say that. Go back and listen to it again.
Right.
And this is a problem in general with people in general. And this is part of why there's this maxim in the media of it in advertising. If you say something three times, it's then true. It's or it's then retained by the watcher of the television. You say, right. Buy these biscuits. You don't say it just once. It's not going to go over. You say it three times. Repetition is a very important way to get across an idea. Now, often that repetition is manipulative or selfish to get across a product. Sometimes it's just to convey what it is the heck you are saying. Now, the only real negative response, or I would call it dismissive or insulting response, was from a reporter. And the reporter was responding to an issue I had posted regarding Scientology on his blog.
Huh.
And it's a very interesting topic because this journalist, who is, in my opinion, overall doing a pretty good, if not remarkable, job with regards to exposing abuse with regards to the subject and organizations of Scientology.
Okay.
And his name is Tony Ortega, and he has a website, and I appreciate that he's actually allowed me to post at all on his blog, which I do not post very often. I don't have a lot of time for posting on any blogs.
Right.
And he's exposing this. And I had brought something up with regard to prosecutions against Scientology are minimal. They're extremely minimal. There's a lot of controversy. There's a lot of
talk.
Civil. Well, a lot of talk. Lot of celebrity banter. There's a lot of civil litigation. And the Scientologists just won a very important case for themselves. And I don't have time to – there's a lot of cases. I don't have time to follow them. There's just basically one that I follow. And this Garcia case I followed to a certain extent. And the Garcias were suing the church for fraud because they had either given or donated a lot of money to the church, and they'd signed documents basically agreeing to arbitration in case of any disputes. And, of course, the arbitration is run by the Church of Scientology. And the problem the Garcias were having, they said there is no arbitration system. They were set up. It was a fraud, and they had the former executives of the Church of Scientology coming in and testifying that it was a sham,
right,
that there was no arbitration, and even the church admitted themselves under direct questioning or whatever the circumstances were that, no, they haven't really done an arbitration case.
Yeah.
And so the judge ruled that because basically he ruled that they had to go to arbitration within the church, even though there had not been, because they'd signed these documents and whatnot, and the judge was protecting the church's religious entitlement that they have achieved.
Okay.
And been granted a status with the Internal Revenue Service as a nonprofit charitable organization in the name of religion.
Okay.
I'm just going to say a point that someone, a legal, I don't know if I call him a legal expert, once told me about the there was a movement back after the militia movement. People don't understand the militia movement very well or what actually happened in that.
What was that?
The militia movement after the siege at Ruby Ridge and Waco,
right,
and during the circumstances of the Oklahoma bombing and all that stuff, there was a big retaliation grassroots movement, which was spirited by something called the militia movement, whereas people were really going for their rights to bear arms, and there was a leader of the Montana militia. I don't remember his name. I was offered an audience with him because I was – my books and persona were circulating around that time in these circles. I never chose to call him. And, in fact, Preston Nichols warned me off of it. I don't know that I would have had time to do anything with him anyway. But this was right as the Internet was coming on.
Okay.
The Internet was, like, really starting to happen.
So like I was 95-ish?
95-ish and even, yes, and even maybe a little bit before. But this was like a freedom of expression for people. And people were calling themselves to arms. And part of what came out of this is that people, you know, this guy named Weaver, I think it was Randy Weaver, the guy whose kid was shot.
Okay.
They came out there, the government came out there, and they shot at him, they shot at his kid. And this was over a tax issue. And you know, I mean, there was a whole, mindset to expose the IRS as an entity that was not really a part of our government.
Yeah.
And it was it was quasi-government at best, and it was separately incorporated, and so was the Federal Reserve, and there's all this jibber jabber, and I don't mean to minimize it by using the word jibber jabber, about the fact that the structure of our government, or what we think is our government, is not really in line with the Constitution. This even goes down.
Oh.
Yes, well, you understand this, but see, yeah. this is something that a lot of people don't understand.
In 1913, something happened that really got screwed up. I mean, right then, I think it was the IRS and the Fed started right around there. But,
well, if we go deeper into this thread, which you don't want to do right now,
yeah.
it goes into some very, very intriguing stuff that has to do with Woodrow Wilson and the Moorish Science Temple and the original indigenous people of this country that we know as the United States of America that was once known as El Maricanos, El Morocco. And there was a relationship with Morocco and the United States back before, well, at the time of the revolution. And because this area was known as El Maricanos. And, of course, this is why you have words like Sharif, which becomes sheriff.
Right.
And cities like Cairo, Illinois, Memphis, Tennessee, that were named after ancient Egypt. And this is intriguing stuff, but this is taking me off the subject. I've written about this in my various books. And one of the problem with my various books is there's so many of them, and some of them are tomes. And what I might have to do or might be a good idea to do in the reasonably near future is to extract some of this data from the books that might be strewn throughout and talk about the Moorish Science Temple, talk about link everything with David Anderson, talk about the blue race and this sort of thing. So this is something that will help people that are new to my work get a primer on a certain subject.
Okay.
But yes, there was a lot. There was a restructuring. The 1929 stock market crash was subsequent to a 1928 Pan-American conference that was taking place in Cuba. And where in attendance was Noble Drew Ali, and he set the world on fire economically because he, at that meeting, according to, I call it historical legend, I've not been able to get a copy of it, but it's probably disappeared on purpose, a mandate basically acknowledging that the land we know, America, at least most of it, was in the proper receivership of the Moorish nationals or the Moorish nation, which would have been El Morocco. That's why it was called El Morricanos, and it was under a some sort of grant that was worked out during the stipulation of Granada. Granada was when the Catholic Church overtook the Moorish, the last Moorish stronghold. King Ferdinand, and Queen Isabella. And this, after Granada, which happened in early 1492, there was the expulsion of the Jews on March 31st, 1492. They expelled all the Jews from Spain. And although they didn't announce it, they sent the Moors home as well. And they told the Moors on that same day, you have to tomorrow to leave. We have ships waiting for you to send you back to Morocco, because they were being exported. The Moors had a different religion. They had a much more tolerant attitude than with the Catholics, who then instigated the Spanish Inquisition.
Right.
And then what you had was 1492, the Moors being expelled, said, we have ships, and the Moors didn't believe them. So they said, okay, well, they showed that they did have ships waiting for them. And as the Moors began to leave, Granada not being on the coast, to go to the ships and to return to El Morocco, to the south, they burned the homes of the Moors and they burned the ships. And this was on the day after March 31st, 1492, April 1st. And this becomes embedded in our minds as April Fool's Day, the day the Spanish crown fooled the Moors.
Okay.
And this is a very, just like, you know, you have, why is 13 a superstitious number?
Yeah.
It's because of October 13th, when the Knights Templars were arrested.
And burned, right? Yeah.
Eventually, Jacques Dumelay was burned, and some of them escaped. So the history of our country is not
pretty,
what we were taught in school. Now, the next agenda of Ferdinand and Isabella is to send Columbus to the New World. And we've all heard the story of how, you know, nobody would listen to him until he found these people as their patron. Well, if you look at the original charter for Columbus, and you can look at it online, it does not mention Asia. They say he's going to Asia. Well, Asia was Asia. They call it the new continent. Marco Polo had already been to Asia. They knew about Asia, but they call it the new continent. Right. Now, the new continent is, I guess you could call it a slanguage in a way, for the idea that they knew it was not Asia.
Yeah.
They knew that America was America. And they went there, and that's a whole other story of the subjugation, and then basically the enslavement of the Moors. The enslavement of the Moors. And this should really be a subject on the Moors.
Yeah.
I'm digressing from this, but back to what you were saying, we were saying is all this weird stuff about the reincorporation of either entities associated with the United States of America or the United States of America itself. I believe that there's even a corporation under that name. And you can go back to the Virginia Company of originally sponsored by Queen Elizabeth, and I think John Dee might have had something to do with that, if I'm not mistaken. I don't. It's sometimes hard to remember all of the things I've covered. But I want to get back to this issue with the I was mentioning the Internal Revenue Service and the Randy Weaver case and the militia case. So there was movement in the United States of America by these people really to bear arms against the forces or the institutions of the United States of America. And this coincided with this David Koresh character in Waco, Texas, or near Waco, Texas, and all of these, the records concerning that ended up in the Oklahoma City bombing, whatever that was, that building, the federal building in Oklahoma City. And then that building blew up, and when that building blew up, there went all the evidence of all the misdeeds that was done by the government in Waco.
Of course.
Now, there were some really far-out theories about Koresh, and I'm not going to go into them, that have nothing to do. They never appeared in the public, and they head more into the mind control area. But I'm not going to – I've covered those in my past newsletters, but that's not really the subject I'm going at. I'm talking here about the militia movement and how it was such a potential threat to the status quo government of the United States of America. And this is during the Clinton administration.
Right.
And you had the government really reeling on its heels, and how are they going to deal with this insurrection?
Well, some of it's going on today.
You know, it never stops.
Yeah.
You don't stop a people, but what you do is you establish a moral climate or an image on the television to suppress and repress the true misery that's going on, the oppression. You don't want to let everybody in the United States think that there's all this oppression going on here or there. And,
right.
And oppression by circumstance or oppression, you know, it's a lot of it's oppression by circumstance. And of course the circumstance is created by ill deeds.
Right. Well, just this past year, there was the cattle rancher in Nevada. I forget his name, but about the government taking his property or moving his cattle off of government property.
Well, yeah, I remember hearing about that. I don't remember all the details, but there's – and then these issues get brought up and polished off and refined in the media. But – I'm finding it very hard to get back on track because it's okay. But as I talk to you, this area I'm talking about is so charged.
Yes.
Politically and emotionally for people. And I'm really trying to get back to this thread to the Church of Scientology.
Yeah.
And this has nothing to do with the Church of Scientology, but it has to do with the, what you would call the thread of revolution and rebellion that was brewing in this country. And I was told quite directly by Preston Nichols, who has his government contacts, that we, myself and him, and we stirred up a lot of, I guess what you call, agita with the government, because this book, The Montauk Project, comes out. It was almost immediately being studied at Duke University. And I knew this from one of my friends who had connections to Duke University. And they had their whole psy-ops or, you know, study of psi phenomena, meaning psychic phenomena.
Right.
Duke University was big on that.
Okay.
And so in other quarters, I'm having, during that time of Waco, and I was not getting on the bandwagon about any of this stuff. I didn't have time. I was doing my own investigation of what we call a space-time project. I didn't want to be drawn into this political morass and revolution. I had friends that were going down to Waco to check it out. I said, well, I don't want to go down there. I mean, because you have so many people covering it. It's just like 9/11. I'm not going to cover 9/11.
Yeah.
I'm not even going to indulge my energy into it. On the day of 9/11, I was going to investigate another space-time project on Manhattan, New Jersey. I couldn't get over the bridge. So I had my own experience with 9/11. But not going into the politics, the theories, the government's reluctance to tell the truth about certain things.
Yeah.
This is just not going to let other people do that. And but back to the militia thing, I was told point blank by Preston Nichols that we were not gone after during that period. when they're going after almost anything. But I say I had a dream during that period of Janet Reno saying, let's arrest him. And somebody says to her, no, they haven't done anything. They just wrote a book. And she says, let's arrest him anyway. You know, it's like, it's like, why am I having that dream? These things are like, because there was a lot of tension in the era then. And we would have been viewed as one of the rabble-rousers. But he told me, he said, they left us alone because we were nonviolent.
Right.
And we did not espouse violence. And one of my concerns at that time was, had the head of the Montana militia taken over the government, or had any of these characters, and with the best of intentions on their own, we would have had probably more chaos and problems than if our extant government remained intact. And this is a mixed bag, because since then, the economy was doing pretty well during the Clinton administration.
Mm-hmm.
And he was heralded for it afterwards. And then what happened, as soon as Clinton went out of office, or as he was going off, out of office, we had the dot-com bust, which, you know, devastated the economy.
I was part of that. That sucked.
Yeah, and it's never really recovered.
No.
It's never really recovered, and people are growing up in a much less desirable environment economically than they would have in 1995,
right,
which was the recovery from the 80s crash. So the militia had to be eradicated. It was the internet was feeding the militia. So what the story I heard from the people, my friends who were following it religiously, who were very much involved in the, at least watching it, if not participating, and I don't think they were participating in it, but they were very sympathetic with it. And the head, I don't even remember his name, he had all these notes and legal papers showing that the United States was indebted to him or a fraud. It was all legal manipulation of papers. It was like he had a lot of paper power.
Okay.
That he could use against the government.
Thank you for listening to the Peter Moon Podcast. To purchase Peter's books, visit skybooksusa.com. Also visit Peter's blog at digitalmontauk.com.
And to hear more music by Noosa, visit noosasounds.com.
He had all this paper power, so basically he felt like he had the government hostage. And maybe he did. He apparently definitely got their attention. Of course, they met with him out in a field, and he had sort of made this arrangement, you know, I'll have this and you'll have this, sort of we'll have our different parties and we'll talk. And he got in this out in the middle of some field in Montana, I believe, and they went out there and they conked him over the head. They conked him over the head, and they basically trumped him up on charges and put him in jail, and he was pretty much finished after that. I've not followed that story closely. This is what I heard.
Right.
There could be more details. I don't know ever what happened to this individual. But at that point, whatever the accuracy of that story is, the militia movement just faded. Because the government had shown a resolution to do anything they could. They had two huge buildings at that time dedicated to monitoring the internet itself.
Yeah.
So this is far beyond the Google era, where Google, everybody knows Google. Google is our friend. And so, which is a whole other government.
Right, supposedly.
Well, I mean, it is. Yeah. The Google. I guess probably he has, there's probably an acronym for government operations. The acronym for Google.
Yeah.
I don't really know other than the obvious. But in any case, the internet became the America's new medium, and it was now a refined medium. In other words, you didn't have rabble rousing going on. It became monitored, and the militia movement was successfully its limbs were cut off. So yes, there's still a spirit of rebellion, and the youth get caught up in it with the Occupy Wall Street, and it's all, and you even have the people leading Occupy Wall Street involved with the government. So you have a lot of games going on, and all of this is about power. It's all about power, and it's also about the rabble or the crowd trying to get justice, and it's very hard to get justice on certain issues in this country.
Yeah.
It's possible to get justice on certain issues, but it's very difficult. So when we talk about the Internal Revenue Service, this is where I was getting back to the Scientology thread and the I guess what you'd say dismissive or insulting response I had with regard to this podcast, the podcast that I'd done on remote viewing and Scientology. And I really don't think they were listened to with any great respect or detail in the first place, which might have been the problem, not really with a comprehension. In other words, he might have been just saying, who the hell is this guy? Let me check him out.
Right.
And as I say, I'm not against what he's doing. I'm supportive of what he's doing, at least for the most part. doesn't mean I agree with everything he says. But I had posted that prosecutions against the Church of Scientology were extremely minimal. Now, part of the problem with this is to prosecute anybody, let alone them. You have to have, in our climate, in our court system, prosecutors often have a hard time convicting anybody. They have a hard time convicting a murderer. They could not convict O.J. Simpson, even though the civil trial showed him to be quite guilty,
yeah,
beyond a reasonable doubt, which they did not have to prove beyond a reasonable doubt, but his testimony was very flawed.
Mm-hmm.
So you have a prosecution system which by its very nature is difficult. But back in the old days of Judge Roy Bean, the prosecution system wasn't so hard. You know, he'd say, hang him.
Yeah.
And he'd hang him, and he was a little too quick to hang. And this is back in the 80s. A man once said to me he says, now scumbags have rights. Back in the old days, they didn't have rights.
Mm-hmm.
So justice is a problem in any situation, in any society, in any circumstance, because justice is what happens when things go wrong. So going back to what was said.
Yeah, what did he say?
I'll get – that's not so important.
Okay.
As for the real issue,
yeah.
which I made a comment that the issue with the Church of Scientology and the raid of what was 1977 was when the FBI raided the churches in 1977 in Washington, D.C., and in Hollywood, California, the two main installations of the Guardian's office. The Guardian's office was the legal arm that handled all the unfortunate dirty business that they had to deal with. And it was there to protect the church, and it had all the legal documents. Now, basically what happened was there was a man named Michael Meisner who was an operative of the Church of Scientology who snuck into an IRS building in Washington, D.C., that I assume it was their headquarters, I don't recall specifically, with another man named Gerald Wolf. And these two people were going into the IRS office and Xeroxing with the government machines all of this papers on Scientology that the government had. And they were, the Scientology was trying to get their name cleared with all this, what they called false documents, that the, or false cases that the IRS was making up against them. Okay. And what happened was they got caught. How they got caught and why they got caught can be disputed. It seems that the story that circulates is that they goofed. They could have been set up to be caught. It's possible Gerald Wolf could have set himself up to be caught. But the most, I guess, conventional wisdom on the matter is that they goofed and they got caught. And Michael Meisner's name, he was using a false name, so they couldn't trace him. He escaped. Wolf had used his real name. And the reason he used his real name was that he needed to get hired at the IRS. He was actually hired by the IRS during a hiring freeze. Huh. Now, this was a very interesting hire because at the time he was hired, there was a acting deputy director of the IRS by the name of Meade Emery. And the reason he's interesting is because he ends up on the Church of Spiritual Technology documents that is the corporate papers. This is the senior body of what we now know as Scientology, the Church of Spiritual Technology. All right.
Yeah, personally, that's, I just want the IRS the hell out of my wallet.
Well, of course. But it's, it was only that simple.
Yeah.
All right, so anyway, with regard to the hiring freeze that was at the IRS, I was stating that Meade Emery was the creator of these, the pattern that incorporated the Church of Spiritual Technology, the senior entity of the Church of Scientology. Now, Meade Emery hires this guy, and prior to that, he was a U.S. tax attorney on a case against the Church of Scientology and or L. Ron Hubbard. So you have there an interesting conflict of interest. He's a U.S. tax attorney, and he ends up drafting the documents to incorporate the Church of Spiritual Technology. Now, this is what's called a conflict of interest in law. A lawyer is not supposed to engage in a conflict of interest.
Right.
He's supposed to be above that. Now, in both cases, he was an attorney. One, he was a U.S. attorney. The other one, he was in private practice. In between, he is hiring Gerald Wolf during a hiring freeze. Now, people in the anti-Scientology movement get very, not all of them, some of them, get very upset when you mention this, or at least in this appears to be the case. This is not the direct, well, it's related to the direct comment, is that I'm not saying there's a conspiracy. Some people have said there's a conspiracy. What you have is a conflict of interest. So when you have a conflict of interest, it begs you to look further. Now, it's very hard for me or other people who were more privy to some of what went on there, but they weren't completely privy because all of this would have been done basically with David Miscavige. The reason they get upset is because what I was saying is it doesn't make sense to most people that the government was conspiring and did all this. It's hard to fathom. It's hard to connect all the dots.
Yeah, some people just won't accept it and don't even have an open-minded mind enough to say, hey, maybe they are doing this.
Well, I'm just saying it's a smoking gun, but it's a smoking gun that doesn't easily go anywhere.
Yeah.
So what I But what I was more concerned than that, that's sort of the background. That's not the actual issue here.
Oh, okay.
It's a background. There are more problems with the person who did the incorporation on the church's side or who helped facilitate some of the reincorporations. A guy named Larry Brannan, who became Denise Brannan and started pumping himself with female hormones and became a woman. I don't know to what degree he became a woman, but and he was being, you know, patted on the back by many of these ex-Scientologists, you know, saying what a great guy he is and all this, and he, it's okay for him to have a gender switch, and this is all really good. And the problem is, when you start pumping hormones into your body, you're killing yourself.
Yeah.
and this is the problem. In other words, this guy's on a death warrant, a self-assigned death warrant. In other words, it's crazy. The guy's crazy.
Yeah.
And I'm not saying he's crazy because he had a sexual or gender issue. He was destroying his body. And meanwhile, he's being cheered on, and it's unfortunate the way people sometimes can't think. Yeah. And I'm not just talking about him, because he obviously had a serious psychological problem in his life. But the way people kind of pat him on the back and kind of say, you know, they don't understand. They don't understand, because we live in a culture that's being fed a lot of information that's not correct. And a lot of this information concerns gender. And I don't think I've mentioned it on this series of podcasts at all.
Mm.
And it's very interesting, because Tony Ortega came out of the Village Voice, which is right, you know, originally Greenwich Village based.
Okay.
And Greenwich Village is, of course, a very predominant, I don't know if it's predominantly, but it's certainly got a lot of gay culture there.
Okay.
It's the center of gay culture. And I've had the experience to speak there several times, and I have friends in this gay culture.
Sure.
And I've sat on the streets with these people, and I've talked to them, and it was one gay man who enlightened me a lot into the what he would call the Velvet Mafia. He didn't make up that term, which is the repressed homosexuals that exist in the ecostructure of the power structure of the United States of America. And we go back to J. Edgar Hoover and Roy Cohn. Roy Cohn was a famous lawyer for McCarthy during the McCarthy hearings, and he became one of the most powerful attorneys in New York. He eventually died of AIDS.
Hmm.
And these people were known as the Velvet Mafia. And I was being taught this by a very, very friendly gay man who was explaining to me what part of the problem of our culture was. He just happened to be a very friendly gay guy.
Yeah.
You know, who understood. He was a very compassionate soul. And I didn't get into his personal issues with him, nor do I have any judgment on him.
Sure.
But what I would say, what's not understood about the gay culture, this is they have the Center for Gay, Lesbian, Transgender Studies, and it's on, I think it's on 13th Street. Don't remember. But I've lectured there. I've heard lectures there. The lectures I go to there or speak on are not about those subjects. But it's what I'm going to say, though, is that the one thing that's not understood in the body of data when they go to study gay, lesbian phenomena is the queen of the gays, or the king of the gays, the king queen of the gays, is Aleister Crowley.
Yeah.
And see, this occult magical linking, this is an occult matrix. And he warns society, or tells society that this is going to become in the future. In his book, The Book of the Law, his preface to it, it's going to be a much bigger issue as the times ahead come. We can call them the end times, we can call them whatever they want, but he brings this issue. So also I'm going to comment on the gay aspect right now, the gay culture issue, is that there's an occult matrix behind that. And that's part of what the Montauk Project utilized, was the occult matrix in relation to the phenomena surrounding Aleister Crowley and his gay rituals.
Huh.
Or parallel to those gay rituals.
So it seems like government and media is now training us to become tolerant of all things gay and transgender.
Well, yes. It's a patterning, it's a indoctrination, and it's okay to be tolerant.
Right.
But what happens is when they start pumping hormones into the milk and people start getting this phenomena known as man boobs.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's funny. It's real funny. This is hormonal. So it's, in other words, there's more to it than, you know, trying to, this is not a good thing. So I don't want to digress onto that, but I'm just saying is the man who was in charge of the corporate sort out or helping draft the documents on the Church of Scientology side was this guy named Larry Brennan who has this real gender issue. So there's another, in other words, smoking gun, if you want to call it. You got this Meet Emery, you got this guy in the corporate sort out who's got some real gender issues. Now, I don't know how, if that has anything to do with anything. I'm just saying, let's put the cards on the table and let's not get angry or let's not get territorial or proprietary about what's going on. This is just, these are the facts.
Mm-hmm.
We don't need to make conclusions with the facts. We need to bring up the facts. Now, the point that I was bringing up was that Michael Meisner, who is the character who basically sort of ran to the FBI and told them his story, which then secured the search warrant to go in and raid the Church of Scientology, because they just couldn't go in and raid the Scientology without a search warrant. So now I go back into the history. So when Gerald Wolf was arrested because they had his name, Michael Meisner had escaped, and he went and reported to his seniors in the Guardian's office in Los Angeles. And they had a problem, and he had a problem. First off, he was basically a fugitive. But the government didn't know his name, and Gerald Wolf would not tell his name. He had a false name. So Gerald Wolf was not coming forth with the name. And had he come forth with the name, the church would have been very angry at him.
Mm-hmm.
And so anyway, they had a problem with Meisner because he had a family. They shouldn't have used an operative with a family. You should not have used it. That was a mistake on their part. And they put him in an apartment under guard because he was a liability to the Church of Scientology. There was a lot of internal communication that went back and forth that included Mary Sue Hubbard, who was communicating from wherever she was located. I think she was located in Los Angeles, in or about Los Angeles at that time. Possibly, I don't know if she was staying in the desert at that time. Anyway, she was, all this communication was transpiring about what to do with him. Now, his main concern was the Gerald Wolf case. And the Gerald Wolf was going to talk. He wanted this to be resolved. Now, according to what I read in and concerning what was called a stipulation of evidence, which seemed to solve this case against the Church of Scientology by the government, was that Gerald Wolf had the statute of limitations run out on him. It was a technicality. And according to what I read years ago, it took me 10 years to figure all this out, by the way. And I put it in my book, The Montauk Book of the Dead, which is my personal story about my life, which includes my adventures with L. Ron Hubbard.
Right.
Working in his office and my Scientology experience. And how I developed and progressed through that and eventually left through their back door rather gently compared to most people.
I'm sorry. Considering our last couple of subjects, that was kind of funny.
It was amazingly gentle compared to what some people went through. And that was I could talk about why it was so gentle, but that's getting off the topic. So anyway, Meisner was concerned about Wolf, and as you say, according to what I'd read, he signed this stipulation or signed this waiving his statute of limitations, which is if this is all true, this is a crazy, crazy thing to do. It's a crazy thing to do if you're Gerald Wolf for your own prosecution, because then you're off the hook.
Right.
Not only are you off the hook, Michael Meisner's off the hook because you're no longer being threatened, and Michael Meisner can be now saying, hey, Mike, you're off the hook. And I'm sweating over the Gerald Wolf case. I'm sweating over it. Now it's gone. Oh, good old Gerald. The only thing he has to have to worry about is if Gerald goes and thinks to the government because he's crazy or whatnot or whatever. So anyway, but he signs a statute which keeps the case active. In the meantime, Meisner is under security. He's being watched. Now, things get bad because the what's happening, the prosecution of Wolf is going forward with hearings and whatnot, and Meisner begins to sweat bullets because it's not going. He's getting antsy. I mean, he can't contact his family. He feels like he's a prisoner.
Right.
And he is a prisoner. And he escapes. But at some point, he's ordered, and this is in the documents, actually comes out in the documents that was seized by the government, is that he is ordered, bound, and gagged, and put into a trunk by Henning Held, who was the deputy guardian U.S. And Henning directly reported to Mary Sue Hubbard. And in some cases, and I don't know in this case that he did correspond to L. Ron Hubbard as well. Not necessarily in this case, I don't know. But he did have personal correspondence with L. Ron Hubbard over certain issues, which I've seen going back to 1975. But this is later than that, and I don't think they found any direct communications concerning this matter with L. Ron Hubbard at all. I'm not saying it's impossible. But in any case, Henning Held ordered him bound and gagged. They put him into a trunk, and they apparently took him across state lines, which this is really crazy.
Huh.
Because when you take somebody across state lines, this gets the FBI into the network. So kidnapping is one of the most heinous crimes you can do in the United States. It's not, and you can get to be put away for a long time. So in any case, Henning Held was doing this to protect the church. And I believe Meisner came back after that kidnapping, but then he got away again. He got scared. He said, and Mary Sue had made some comments to him. I read them that, kind of threatening his future as far as being able to do, his immortal future with Scientology or something. I'd seen a dispatch she wrote that was or basically saying, you better tell him, blah, 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 blah. And he's listening, you're telling me this, look, I'll settle for having a normal life and going to the FBI. They're not going to bother me as much as you people are. They're not going to keep me. So he went and ratted to the FBI. People have thought that he was a double agent. I don't Don't know that he was. I don't think he was, but my opinion is meaningless. The same with Gerald Wolfe. He smells more like a double agent. These are curious questions.
Yeah.
Because although Tony Ortega has done a good job of bringing back old people that knew L. Ron Hubbard, he's not had the good or bad fortune, whatever it might be, to have either one of these characters come on. Now, what happened is Meisner, this is what set Meisner up to, and then they got the warrant. Now, I was bringing up this issue, trying to bring up this issue, but I'm not going to let this issue alone just yet, because this is irrespective of the disrespectful comment I received. But what is utterly fascinating about this case is that the way it was settled with the government was called a stipulation of evidence, where they took all the evidence about these matters, perhaps all the people that were involved, and it was known as the Scientology Nine. It included Mary Sue Hubbard and a host of other people that were involved in this conspiracy against the government. And the government drew up a stipulation of evidence. They signed it, and they did not enter pleas of guilty or not guilty. And they basically took a jail term. Now, I had read at the time I investigated this 10 years ago that this was unprecedented. I know somebody says, this is not precedent. Oh, this is common. If people do it. Well, you know, I'm trying to establish a dialogue and a discussion on this blog. Instead, I get, you know, sort of not harshly bombarded, not really bombarded, but it's kind of like, let's not talk about the facts. This is all, you know, I get challenged on points that are not really the way you challenge a point. It's not an intellectual. Of course, blogs aren't known for their intellectual discussion all the time.
Right.
But the stipulation of evidence in this circumstance, I just asked an attorney of a very prestigious, not an attorney, he's a dean, he was the dean of a very prestigious law school who I happen to know personally. And not only was he a dean, he was a teacher. He taught law. And I asked him about this. Stipulation of evidence with neither party, but the parties pleading neither guilty nor not guilty. He says, I've never heard of it. Hmm. So when I read that it was unprecedented, now I go back to a little bit more asking questions, and yes, it is unprecedented. This was an unprecedented thing. Now, we have to ask, why did they not bring these people to trial? They didn't want to bring them to trial. And they threatened them with heavy jail sentences. In my book, The Montauk Book of the Dead, I explained that I think what Mary Sue should have done was just make herself the supreme sacrifice and say, look it, I'm not guilty, and have a legal argument and go after the government with all the fury that a legal case can go into. And say, you know, if you want to put me in jail for the rest of my life, do so. They're not going to put her in jail for the rest of her life.
No.
And when I say she should have done that, she should have thrown all her ammunition, because what happened to her was not pleasant. She had a soft jail term and a soft, you know, soft jail. And she lived her life in what turned out to be abject, and from what I've been able to determine, misery. She got breast cancer. The church was taken away from her. She was the controller of the church. She had a lot of personal defeat. She didn't even get acknowledgement from her husband at the end of her life. And it was, her life did not go well. And she couldn't have done worse by doing the route I suggest. But, you know, it's not easy for a person to say, you know, I'm gonna go at you with all I can. Now, they didn't want to go after, the government did not want this to go to trial. They didn't want any of these people that were involved to go on the witness stand. Because had they gone on the witness stand, at some point they would have discussed what materials they had on the government. Now, this would have included the Xerox documents they had from in and about the IRS.
Mm-hmm.
This was not the only government agency they infiltrated. And the whole idea of the reason you would do this sort of an operative if you were them is because the Freedom of Information Act isn't working.
Yeah.
Okay. It's not working. Well, what information do you have on us? We can't say that. You know, we're not going to say that. We give you this. We're going to black it all out. So what is national security? You know, blacking out, not giving you. The Freedom of Information Act is a ruse. It can be useful.
Thank you for listening to the Peter Moon Podcast. To purchase Peter's books, visit skybooksusa.com. Also visit Peter's blog at digitalmontauk.com.
And to hear more music by Noosa, visit noosasounds.com.
So, in 1976, I was given a briefing along with, I believe, it was most of the staff in Clearwater, Florida. I don't know if it excluded certain parties, but it was a pretty big audience, so I think it included basically everybody who was staff.
Yeah.
And it was a staff. It was a briefing from the Guardian's office by the, I guess he was called the Assistant Guardian Information, Stephen Hurd, and he went into a fascinating lecture about all the investigations they'd done into the government, and this had nothing to do with the IRS. This had to do with the Golden Triangle in Southeast Asia, the whole drug running operation that the government was doing.
Wow.
And this is at a time when it really wasn't that well known. It's pretty much known now. And they were digging up all this dirt on the government because you got to remember that Scientology had an intelligence network that was bigger than most governments.
Huh.
It was that big.
I didn't know that.
No, but they did.
Yeah.
And they were digging up all this dirt. And this is part of what I mentioned earlier with Mae Brussel. But Mae Brussel and what she was interested with them was just a fraction. Omar Garrison, a journalist they had hired, wrote a book called The Secret War Against Beliefs that went into some of this. But the real hardcore stuff, he didn't really go into. From what we were being briefed upon and what I recall. And he told us, he says, I'm letting you guys in on real inside stuff here, which there was much more that he wasn't telling us. Now, all of this information on the government, the investigations they were doing at a time when conspiracy was not in fashion. The only conspiracy in fashion at that time was they were reviewing the JFK assassination during the late 70s.
Yeah.
They concluded it was a conspiracy. They've later changed their minds. But, so anyway, it was a conspiracy. It wasn't a conspiracy. It was a conspiracy. It wasn't a conspiracy. So anyway, the government had a motive to go in and raid the Church of Scientology that was completely above and beyond anything the IRS was doing. So if this went to trial and you had these people, these Scientologists, the only two other names I remember off the top of my head, other than Gerald Wolf and Mary Sue Hubbard, were Henning Helt and a guy named Duke Snyder. And I only remember him because of the baseball player named Duke Snyder. They had the same name. It was not the same person. And there it was some others. It was a guy named Moe Budlong and Jane Kember, the Guardian worldwide, they were both in the UK. They had to be extradited. They were not part of this case. They were extradited separately. I don't know if there were any, if all that information that they had in Hollywood and in Washington, D.C. was also duplicated in the U.K. Don't know if it sat there. Omar Garrison had warned them, if you have any sensitive stuff, get them off the premises. He warned them. They didn't do it. They did not listen to his advice. Of course, he was just somebody they hired. They apparently didn't have too much respect for him with regard to his advice. And he was a touted journalist. Of course, the problem with touted journalists is they work for hire, and he was working for hire. So, and he later switched sides. Of course, if you see all the circumstances, it's understandable why he switched sides. But in any case, this case, if they had these people getting up there and saying, well, yeah, well, we found this about the government. Yeah, we had these documents. And by the way, what did you do with our documents? You took our documents. We want to defend ourselves with those documents. They could have made legal jousting and posturing to get those documents back, at least for the defense of what they were doing. In the meantime, the government was threatening to throw away the key. Now, when a prosecutor threatens you, almost always it's 75-80% bluff.
Right.
And people don't realize this because they're scared. So, okay, so go ahead and prosecute me. A lot of bluffing goes on.
Hmm.
But when it's the rest of your life, sure, you're understandably frightened.
Yeah.
I don't think Scientology's lawyers did a very good job. I think that they were intimidated. If they weren't in the hire of the government themselves, I don't know who they used. I don't know. But in any case, now, there's another issue here, which they had the evidence that Henning Help had ordered the kidnapping of Michael Meisner. Now, this is another thing that was not brought up. And when you kidnap somebody and you take them across state lines, even if you don't take them across state lines, this is considered very heinous in our legal system. And why didn't they prosecute him for kidnapping? Now, because there were so many other people involved, they could have even configured a case where Mary Sue Hubbard was an accessory. And because they mentioned Hubbard, L. Ron Hubbard, as an unindicted conspirator, maybe they could have, angled that too. I don't know what information they had on that. But the point I'm saying is, why don't you prosecute this man for kidnapping? Now, I would say that Henning Help, from what I knew of him, and I did not know him personally, was not a danger to go on out and kidnapping other people. I don't think at all that he was a danger, because he was doing this with a very specific motive in mind. However, that's not the way the law and prosecutors look at things. And that's just my opinion. And it may not be right, but I think it is. So in other words, why do you let a kidnapper go?
Yeah.
And these are questions that I have and I wanted to bring to the discussion. And there's also another thing that I did bring to the discussion, but the IRS had over 100 agents waiting in South Carolina, Charleston, South Carolina, waiting for L. Ron Hubbard and his ship, the Apollo, to arrive. They were going to come straight to South Carolina and come to the United States. This was in 1974 when the ship came across the Atlantic. I think it was a 10-day voyage or something like that. It was, I don't know how long it was. Maybe it wasn't that long, but it was they went from, I believe it was Las Palmas to Bermuda, where they got all the refueled and did all that sort of thing, and then they were going to come to America. They ended up going to the Caribbean, the Bahamas and the Caribbean,
mm-hmm.
where I rejoined the ship in June of 1975. And I was treated to all of these stories firsthand by friends that were involved in the telexes or the communications back forth. I think one of my friends was in Charleston, South Carolina, and he alerted, hey, there's 100 agents here waiting to impound the ship and arrest L. Ron Hubbard. And this went back, actually went back to the ship where Hubbard was saying, let's go in. We haven't done anything wrong. He's actually saying this. We have not done anything wrong. And Mary Sue gets a telex from Jane Kember or a wire, might have even been a radio message. I think it was a radio message that says, don't do it. And she told him about the guards, says, we're not doing it. They had a screaming and shouting match, and she convinced him not to go in, which would not have been good for certainly for the Hubbards, and probably not for Scientology. Now, my point is that they have 100 agents waiting to seize the ship. What is going on here? This is way before the raid. Yeah. In other words, if you have 100 agents, there is a big, big, huge amount of internal communication in the IRS. And what is it based upon?
Sure, they don't just show up.
Exactly. So there's a whole bunch of records that the Scientologists were going after and that they were taking, which is supposedly a public institution by the people for the people. And they're trying to get, why are you going after us? What is the whole reason and being? So Scientology infiltrated the government, and people act outraged about this. And it's understandable that they're outraged, but what's the other side doing? And these are questions I still want to know.
Mm-hmm.
I still want to know. I'm not aligned with Scientology, but I would like to know these questions because they will eventually come out.
Right.
Now,
and ironically, last week, Obama said the White House no longer has to reply to Freedom of Information Act requests. I'm sorry.
Perhaps anyway. So see, this is the thing. So much when that stuff comes up, they never have anyway. I mean, it's like,
right.
Sure, I'm sure they'll give you something out if you're looking for your, you know, lost uncle who has a will for you or something and you want to find out what happened to him. I'm sure they'd help
you. Yeah, but don't ask anything about them.
Well, of course not. I mean, but this goes into the issues of power.
Sure.
Of which you cannot separate Scientology in its former existence or in its current existence. It's all about power.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a book I eventually hope to write about Hubbard from the aspect of power. But when we go into the power, it's not just a political power. There's an occult power, a matrix underneath all of this stuff. Now, back to the issue with Tony Ortega. He told me I had my facts messed up and that Meisner was the whole thing, and he's going to cover in his book, which is coming out. And his book is coming out to be released after this documentary called Going Clear is released next Sunday, a week from tonight.
Yeah.
It's the 22nd of March as we do this podcast on the 29th, and it's already premiered. And so he says his book's going to cover it. And maybe his book will. And I wished him success on his book. But where the insult occurred was he said that he was surprised I didn't bring UFOs or Satanism into it. Because he listened to my podcast, and I think he said that, you know, listen to my ravings. Now, have I been raving?
No.
All right. And he, of course, you're new to all of this.
Yes. I'm just trying to soak it all in.
So, anyway, and the now this is a very interesting point about UFOs. Of course, I told him that I'm not, if you read my body of work, and I can't expect him or much anybody else to read my body of work, it's too big.
Right.
I'm not a UFO buff. I published a book about UFOs with Preston Nichols and his experiences. I don't disbelieve in UFOs, but I'm saying I'm not somebody who's going to sit there and go into all this. I consider most of the UFO field very misguided. But sure, are there UFOs? Yeah, anything up in the air is unidentified and flying.
Right.
Douglas Dietrich has given us some good insights into that. And then there's the Satanism. Now, the Satanism is, I'm talking about Mae Brussel, who's a very real person who did very real investigations. Much of it was based upon the newspaper and the implications that were going from newspaper stories. And it was outrageous what she turned up.
Right.
And
from the Presidio and the...
she wasn't. She was approaching the Presidio. What she was investigating was coming out of the Presidio from the newspaper accounts. Yes.
Yes.
But even before that, with the whole JFK Nazi connection.
Oh, okay.
I mean, there have been books on that. There's a whole body of investigation that he might not be... If he's aware of it at all, he's not too well briefed on it. You know, he's doing what he's doing. Now, the Satanism thing is disturbing to me when somebody, you know, kind of makes a jibe at me when I'm saying things very cogently. You can look up Michael Aquino and see that he is has served as the deputy director of the National Security Agency. Now that's, and he's not like hiding that he's a Satanist. Now the Temple of Set. So I'm saying is, what? Well, am I making this stuff up? Oh, is that just his religion? When I moved to Long Island in 1983, there was satanic murders going on. It was in the newspaper.
Right.
So Satanism is not something that one should be dismissive of. It is very problematic to deal with. And here, and I just want to make a comment about, right here, there is a division between what I do and what you would call pedestrian journalism, which is what Tony does.
Okay.
And when I say pedestrian, I don't mean that as an insulting term, because it's the walk-a-day world of, you know, facts and figures, or what are you supposed to do? And when we don't open for a dialogue or for, I mean, if you don't have time to dialogue it, that's fine. But the snarkiness is not healthy.
No.
And
it becomes very one-sided.
Well, yeah, and you know, he has a whole website dedicated against him.
Oh, and really?
At first I thought it was the Church of Scientology, and it's not. It's a billionaire who he pissed off because he accused, or he didn't accuse him. Well, I think he has, but he did an article by another woman who said that this guy was having sex with his daughter, and this guy used all his resources to take down Tony Ortega any way he can. So, and seeks to point out everything he's done that's wrong, and some of the accusations are pretty nasty. And I'm just not going to go there because I don't know, you know, they're written as if they're accurate, balls on accurate, but I don't know that, and I want him to continue doing what he's doing.
Yeah.
So I'm not going to go there. But this pedestrian journalism, and then there's occult writing. There's occultism. I'm an occult writer who also happens to be adept at pedestrian journalism. And I've kept a journal since 1993, the Montauk Pulse, which is by subscription. I've been doing that for over 20 years.
Right.
Now, some of that is dedicated to occult writing, and some of it is dedicated to pedestrian journalism.
Thank you for listening to the Peter Moon Podcast. To purchase Peter's books, visit skybooksusa.com. Also visit Peter's blog at digitalmontauk.com.
And to hear more music by Noosa, visit noosasounds.com.
Welcome to the Peter Moon Podcast, brought to you by Sky Books and the music of Noosa.
Around, I'm showing you these signs. I've been Okay, so this is podcast number 4, part 2, on the general subject of remote viewing. And it's been a challenge to get at the actual core subject of the techniques that I will eventually share, which are in the book, The White Bat, The Alchemy of Writing. But what's more important than the techniques is the environment one is in. And the environment is your mental environment, your emotional environment, your literal physical environment. And there's something also called, we can call it the ecosphere, which would include the spiritual environment. Now, we haven't completely, there's one little bit, we were untangling the connection of Scientology to remote viewing in its the history of the subject.
Right.
And I want to touch, as we move forward, just a couple of points that I missed. And in the earlier podcast, part one, I was talking about the IRS and the issues with the IRS. And there was one point I did not get to mention about the IRS and the militia movement.
Okay.
At that same time, many people who were either in the militia movement, aligned with it, sympathetic with it, or just existing at that same time, were constructing themselves or incorporating themselves as religions. Now, this was something that might seem very dubious at the initial examination of it. An individual proclaiming himself to be the sole practitioner of a particular religion. While there's nothing wrong with that, people are going to look at it with a jaundiced eye, of course, because they're going to say, well, they're doing it for their advantage, their tax advantage. Right. So one of the items in this is when you apply in this manner, and I have not chosen to go this route myself, and if you go and declare yourself to be a religion, the IRS will send you a form asking if you would like to us, meaning the IRS, to adjudicate on this and give you a full status as a religion. And I don't remember the mumbo jumbo language, I don't think it's a 501c3. Maybe it is. I don't remember. But they would ask you, would you like us to rule on this? And, of course, if you'd like us to rule on this, sign this form. And when you sign this form, so the people who were doing this said, if you sign this form, well, then you've suckered into their system. And you don't have to sign the form at all. And you have every right to maintain your own religion. And you don't need their approval. Right. So, in other words, you get snookered into seeking their approval. And when you get snookered into seeking their approval, then you are a fair game or fair bait for the IRS to go after you. Now,
nobody wants that kind of attention.
No, but the point of it is, as was being not only argued but practiced by these small practitioners of their religious faith, and you might cynically say that their religious faith was to avoid taxes.
Yes.
And that could be interpreted as a legitimate religious faith because we have freedom of religion here.
Right.
So essentially you can believe anything you want to, no matter how foolhardy or stupid it is.
Yeah.
Stupid in the eyes of others. And it makes you sovereign. Now, and of course, I find it, as I'm living with others, it's easier to interact with others under the presuppositions of others, at least when you're dealing with legal matters and if you own a house. And, you know, you don't want to be stepping on toes unless you can absorb or retaliate with regard to the full consequences. And there have been many people who've not necessarily gone this particular route that I'm talking about, but they've gone other routes of declaring themselves sovereign only to lose their house and have all their possessions thrown out because they were refusing to pay their mortgage under similarly sovereign vehicles of identity, which did not work in practice. They might be totally legal, but they did not work in practice for certain people. So, and there's a lot of hucksters that will try and sell people this sort of thing. But back to what I was saying is, the attorneys for the Church of Scientology obviously did not go this route. They did not go the route that the quote-unquote militia people were going. And it might have been a more advantageous route. I can't say. But it's just a comment I was making with regard to the militia and the radical revolution that was going on at that time in the 1990s, which is now 20 years ago.
Yeah.
That's in the relatively distant past. Now, there's another point I want to point on with regard to the incorporation of the Church of Spiritual Technology, which is, again, the senior body of Scientology that licenses the trademarks and copyrights of Dianetics and Scientology. If you look at the construct, there's these special directors. I believe there's three, if my memory serves correct, and they are attorneys. They are not Scientologists. And the interesting part is, when they are, they're permanent there until death, and if one is replaced for whatever reason, whether by death, or whether they have to, maybe they retire, they have to be approved, the replacement, by the California State Bar Association. Now,
for religion, they have to be approved by the state?
Well, for this corporation.
Oh.
Yes. Yes, by the State Bar Association. Now, on the outset, this might seem like a reasonable request because you want an attorney who's in good standing with the Bar Association. But if you look at where is the State Bar Association, it's a part of the California State Supreme Court.
Yes.
So therefore, you have an admixture of religion and state. You do not have a genuine separation of church and state. So people in the earlier instances I brought up with these issues of saying, let's look at this. People will point their finger and say, oh, that's conspiracy. There's no, your church, you know, when you start pointing the finger and saying, that's conspiracy. This is an accusation in itself when one is just presenting facts. And one is drawing no conclusions from these facts other than that they are odd and irregular facts. And odd and irregular facts beg one to look further into these irregularities. And it's clearly, if this is the case, which is certainly how it's written up and presented to the public, that the California State Bar Association has some jurisdiction or direction over who can serve on the board of a church. Well, it's one of the most fundamental principles of the United States of America is being compromised rather severely, even if it's just sitting there willy-nilly. Doesn't matter. So these are issues that have not been well scrutinized, and I would imagine with irregular facts there's more. I would imagine this is the tip of the iceberg in some respects of data that has not come out, because even the people who've spoken out and are regarded as experts on this subject, Scientology was very compartmentalized. And it's compartmentalized to a certain degree on purpose. But then it's so vast and wide of a network, it's very easy for people to not be there during a certain time or to not know this or not know that. And some of it is circumstantial and some of it is on purpose. So these were a couple of points that I wanted to bring up that were not either fully, I didn't elucidate on them, or they were part of what I was talking about. So we can move on from those points, recap the data that we lost. And one of the things I was discussing was pedestrian journalism versus occult writing or occult journalism, because pedestrian journalism is only going to take you so far. In other words, you have a document here, a document there, this proves that, this proves that. And even sometimes, even when you have documents proving things, it still does not give you an effective method or weapon to use in a court battle. It depends.
And by pedestrian journalism, you're talking about just normal everyday news, broadcasts, national media, that sort of thing.
Well, yes, and not only that, but the pedestrian act of looking up data in files, verifying things, documenting things, and doing a routine job in a routine circumstances. Now, even that, you take something like the JFK assassination, pedestrian journalism goes into the realm of murder, crime, mob. And I once talked to a detective who was trying to help me with a certain matter I was taking care of. You know, in the scheme of things, he said he had many unsolved homicides he had to deal with, so he wasn't going to attend to mine for the next several days or whatever I needed from him. And these homicides are undetected, several of them. And they're not read about in the newspapers. They're not printed in the newspapers. It's just a dead body. Now, if one were to be, as they say, to do a pedestrian journalism and start to take the names of these people, find out a little bit about them, pretty soon with certain murders, you're going to find a common denominator. And these common denominators do not want to be investigated. So you're going to get into some pretty hairy areas at times. And in other words, there's just much more that goes on in the crime scene, not only of the county where I live, but New York City, right adjacent to where I live. And that, they don't report all the crime. So to whose advantage is that? Sometimes it's just like there might be too much to report. You can't put too much negative attention out there at the same time. But if you continue pedestrian journalism past a certain point using pedestrian means, it does not become pedestrian anymore.
Right.
You're moving into a realm of what could be called fear, threat, and it will eventually go into the occult. And I was talking about the Son of Sam as a example of a journalist, Maury Terry, who wrote the book Ultimate Evil. It was about the Son of Sam murders. And this book was heralded by journalists.
That was 77 or 78, right?
The Son of Sam murders were in 77.
Yeah, that's when I was a little kid on Long Island.
Remember. The book was written in the 80s.
Okay.
And he was a journalist for a newspaper up in the Westchester area, which I call the 914 area code. And he went to school with some of the people that were involved in the Son of Sam cult, if it can be called that. Now, the problem with his investigation, and he was chronicling the investigation of a police officer who was questioning all the stuff that went down. In other words, the whole data presented in that book is there was a whole group, a cult of people that were involved in a satanic cult, and they were associated with a man named Sam Carr, who lived in Westchester. And he had a son, John Carr and Michael Carr, who were, according to the book, were involved in the murders, and according to Berkowitz as well, as he's begin to confess and say what happened. He was not the lone gunman who was taking directions at the order of his dog.
Right.
And as I mentioned, that the Son of Sam stood for Uncle Sam, even though there was a man named Sam Carr.
Yeah.
The Uncle Sam was that this was a directed series of murders being directed by a secret source in either in collaboration with or inside of or on behalf of the government. Just like with the Charles Manson situation, there was all sorts of government military surveillance equipment that was monitoring them in and around the Spahn Ranch. And this is all stuff that's, you know, been brought up for years.
Right. What was the connection between the people that were killed and the government?
Well, just the whole idea was that these cults were being, not the people that were killed.
Oh.
It was just that the enabling of the murders was serving a beast, serving a diabolical source that was either inside of the government or being enabled by the government or was serving. Basically,
so they were letting this happen.
Yes, or enabling it, because this policeman who was fighting and trying to bring out the truth on the case was being thwarted at every step. And I think if I remember the story correctly, he was sued. He got into hot water with the district attorney of Brooklyn. And in the midst of the district attorney in Brooklyn putting all this pressure on him, this district attorney was found guilty of pedophilia, and he was removed from his job, and it was a big mess. But still, nothing really came forward. And the author of the book comments on how the higher up you go in the food chain, of whether it be the police or the people that the police answer to, there's a certain point where there's a buffer zone. This stuff is not, it doesn't serve the powers that be to pursue this further. First of all, it's costly and time consuming to investigate. But there's a point where they don't receive cooperation on the upper levels. And you can blame it on politics. You can blame it on insanity. You can blame it on a lot of different things. But it's a difficult area. So what happens is you're now no longer doing pedestrian journalism, because the routine, you know, getting the goods on the guy, sending it to the powers that be, whether it be the press or the law enforcement, it just doesn't work anymore.
Huh.
It's just, so you're now in the realm of hidden forces and hidden factors. Now, this is an area which I directly got involved with when I investigated the Montauk Project. And the Montauk Project was an accumulation of stories that Preston Nichols had collected over a very long time, the better part of a decade. And when I wrote them, it was all his story, his vernacular. There was no particular effort by him to prove things. And he even said, he says, if I prove this, I'd be killed. I don't want to prove it. So when I wrote that book, I discovered that the routine pedestrian journalistic sources were pretty much stonewalled. And it was not easy to find anything. And this was corroborated by a New York Times reporter who actually sought out to do this book himself before I was even on the scene.
Huh.
And he got scared and didn't do it. Eventually, he read the book and said, I did a very good job. So this was not a pedestrian issue. When I then began to investigate it, instead of finding the pedestrian leads I would have liked to have found, approaching this from a very pedestrian standpoint, I then began to experience coincidences, uncanny coincidences, unlikely coincidences, which are the subject of the book Montauk Revisited, Adventures in Synchronicity, and how this all traced back to occult connections to Aleister Crowley, L. Ron Hubbard, Jack Parsons, and his wife Marjorie Cameron, which is not really the subject of this interview. But I began to be associated with her and had several conversations with her. And this was, so I was now in the realm of the occult and coincidentally had a background in the occult from having studied it only as a result of having been involved with L. Ron Hubbard and then reading the depth to which his occult connection went. In the book L. Ron Hubbard, Messiah or Madman, by Ben Corydon and L. Ron Hubbard Jr. That book, now I already knew that there was a connection with Jack Parsons and Aleister Crowley with Hubbard, but I did not know the extent to which it was. And, of course, my response was not to be upset or shocked, but was, if Hubbard knew these things, I wanted to see what he knew. What was he doing? So I began to study Crowley and everything I could get my hands on. This was in the 1980s,
right.
Late 1980s. And that gave me a background in understanding this. And I'm going to go a little deeper into it in a further podcast, not right now, with regards to how I could go deep into this and sort of make it all synchronized together. It has to do with coherency and understanding things. Because a lot of people go into this occult realm, not everybody, but they go into it and they get pretty messed up because these occult schools, books, whatever they are, they have a carrier way with something riding along with it, which is not sometimes consumes people or gets them either possessed or virtually possessed. As I say, not in every case, but it's too frequent. And I've noticed, and it took me a long time to notice it. And just one example of, well, many examples, is I...
Like the person actually gets possessed for researching the occult?
Well, let me... This is where I first really... It came home to me, and this came years after later I'd been studying it, is that I would encounter people now and then who would read Aleister Crowley and thought they were Aleister Crowley, the reincarnation of Aleister Crowley.
Oh.
It was more than once. Then I found out that this was common. There are many people. Just like if you counsel or audit, it's the word in Dianetics and Scientology, people, you will find many people who either were crucified at the crucifixion of Jesus Christ or were there. And there's far too many of them. There's far too many, as they say, you could fill up Yankee Stadium with them. And
why do you think that is?
Well, because they can relate to it. They have been indoctrinated with an incident that is stuck to them. It sticks to them. So when they go back to think of a point in time, their memory is dominated by that idea or that thought. It's a form of imprint, if not possession itself.
Cool.
And it's very interesting, if not liberating, to look at the character that people think of when they say Jesus Christ, and to view that particular construct that they've constructed in their minds as something other than what they think it is, something that is possessing their attention, something that is taking their energy. And usually when it's taking their energy, it's taking their energy to feed a political construct, such as a church or a denomination of some sort.
Right, but sometimes with something like that, that's something that's instilled in a person from, like, the time they can speak.
It could be.
Religion, for me anyways, as growing up Catholic in New York, I mean, religion was a very big part of my parents' families, my family. You're taught from a very young age, you know, stories from the Bible.
Right. You're right.
You're told to believe. Do what I say when I say it.
Yes, and these things need to be examined by any individual. Now, there are people that do have spiritual, genuine spiritual experience with the constructs or figures or spiritual entities that align with Christ or angelic hierarchies and whatnot. But I did meet a minister once who told me that the Christian sects in his city where he lived were all fighting with each other on the astral plane. Their angels are better than our angels are better than your angels, sort of thing. And he said they were all very misguided, and I would tend to agree with him. And so you might hear stories of Wiccans who cast spells against each other. Well, these were Christians, called themselves Christians, and here they were, you know, fighting each other on the astral plane, and they used the term astral plane. So my angels are better than your angels. As what is it in that famous fight with Evander Holyfield versus Mike Tyson? Tyson was now proclaiming himself to be a Muslim. Holyfield, who was a Christian, said, you know, my God is more powerful than his God. This is something less than what religion should be in an idealized way. So anyway, I'm just saying here is the construct that people have in their minds is not necessarily what the real fundamental principle behind the idea of a Christian Messiah is, would, or could be. So all I'm saying is people are entitled to their views and their religious beliefs.
Oh, of course.
But it behooves them to examine and re-examine what it is they're actually believing as opposed to automatically thinking. And all I'm saying is the average individual, if he really looks deeply, he might find that his calculations are not exactly either correct or in his best interests.
I'm a big George Carlin fan, and he always said to question everything. And I loved that when he said it.
Well, yes. And, of course, the problem with somebody who views the world like that is that they become far too cynical.
Well, that's true.
And this is, and I'm not inviting people to be cynical.
No.
I'm inviting them to be enlightened but you have to treat this stuff with a certain amount of cynicism, because when you go into the actual literal interpretation of the word Jesus Christ, it's not what most people think it is. Most people couldn't even define the word Jesus or where it comes from, the historical antecedents of that word, which I've talked about and written about quite a bit.
Thank you for listening to the Peter Moon Podcast. To purchase Peter's books, visit skybooksusa.com. Also visit Peter's blog at digitalmontauk.com.
And to hear more music by Noosa, visit noosasounds.com.
Welcome to the Peter Moon Podcast, brought to you by Sky Books and the music of Noosa.
I was talking about the seven Son of Sam murders earlier.
Yes.
And how that was not pedestrian journalism. And I got into that in the data that we lost. And I don't even know if I want to reconstruct it.
Okay.
But I will say this. This is interesting. Is that all of these, the cult used to meet and abuse people and sacrifice animals and whatnot in a place called Untermeyer Park. And Untermeyer Park is very interesting because it's constructed on a Kabbalistic theme, like the Kabbalistic Tree of Life. And the reason for that is that Untermeyer was a Kabbalist. Okay, he's the one who was a very wealthy man. And
what's a Kabbalist?
Okay, good question.
Sorry.
Kabbalist is somebody who studies and has some degree of proficiency in the Kabbalah.
Okay.
And the Kabbalah is the, I guess what you call the mystery tradition of the Judaic religion. And the Judaic, every religion will have a outer mystery and an inner mystery and a hidden mystery. And in the Jewish religion, you have the Old Testament, which is the book for the outer people. This is what you need to know. Then you've got the Talmud, which is the commentaries, interpretations on the Old Testament. That's for the rabbis. And then the Kabbalah is the mystical tradition, the inner secret tradition. Now, the Kabbalah is basically a fundamental synthesis of archetypes. And an archetype is just a basic fundamental construct of life. And the tarot cards are based upon archetypes. They're also based upon the Kabbalistic Tree of Life. And all of the Kabbalah is based upon the patterning of DNA. So it's really just a way of explaining life. And there are different interpretations of the Kabbalah. There's, if it's spelled with a K, it's Jewish. If it's spelled with a C, it's Christian Kabbalah. And if it's spelled with a Q, Kabbalah, it's Islamic.
Huh.
So there are more fundamental Kabbalistic constructs even beneath the Jewish one, which would be your African Kabbalah, which is based upon, much more based upon a feminine interpretation. But the only point, you just asked what a Kabbalist is, and there's, of course, all sorts of literature, mumbo jumbo and whatnot. But the one thing that often gets missed, and this was what I learned through the decoding of Aleister Crowley's Book of the Law, that it gives the construct and demonstrates that the Kabbalistic Tree of Life is indeed the template for DNA. Or DNA is the template for the Kabbalistic Tree of Life. Depends how you look at it. But basically, that's a whole delineation I showed in the Montauk Book of the Living.
Now, do you think they knew that back then?
It's hard to say.
Okay.
It's not that unusual for somebody to say that it corresponds. I've seen websites that recognize this. But it's an underappreciated truth,
right,
that it does correspond to DNA. So people can be very structured and very fixed about the Kabbalah and how this, and they be very fixed and rigid. Life is not fixed or rigid. So
welcome to the Peter Moon Podcast, brought to you by Sky Books and the music of Noosa.
Go back in time.
I find it interesting that, you know, I don't know how much you got into the whole Sandy Hook thing, but, you know, they say all these kids got killed at the school, which is a, you know, terrible thing. But, you know, they've gone ahead and they've demolished the school where this supposedly happened, and they also demolished the house of the supposed shooter. They've also demolished that. So, you know, so much for forensic evidence.
Well, this is all too typical.
Yeah.
This is all too typical. And I knew one woman who was investigating a satanic cult connected to Anton LaVey, and it was in the Utah area, and it began to her house that she was renting while she was investigating was suffering spontaneous combustion.
Huh.
So you're actually dealing at a certain level with an occult force, a powerful force. And this is what one is dealing with. So you can understand why an ordinary human being or an ordinary reporter is not going to penetrate this area. And sometimes even the evidentiary trail of the pedestrian journalist is going to get skewed by forces that are beyond the ordinary. And this will often, sometimes, also filter through attitudes in the people that you're trying to reach or trying to get to help you. Like I had this problem in the Montauk investigation early on when people would not help me. They'd make dirty comments.
Right.
Like this nothing happened here. Nothing happened here. Okay. Well, just, instead of acting, they could have acted wide eyes and interest, and people would lie and do things. And it's just because you're dealing with a force. Now,
Whose force?
Well, we're going to address this. I'm going to do it in a little bit of a lead up here.
Okay.
And the first thing I want to say about the Scientology phenomena and the fallout associated with it is that it becomes a feeding frenzy on negative energy, whereby you have ex-Scientologists or anti-Scientologists rabidly going against the icon of L. Ron Hubbard and Scientology and showing and demonstrating abuses. And they're not necessarily incorrect in reporting some of these. I've seen some of the iterations by people who've suffered abuses, and their information is sometimes not accurate. And when I say it's not accurate, it's because I know some of the people, and they're giving wrong dates and times. And although I will say on their behalf that sometimes these dates and times are irrelevant to the issue at hand.
Right.
However, if one was an attorney against them, one would chop them up left, right, and center on certain points and then use that to impugn their testimony on the other things. So what we have going on in the public arena of Scientology is, as I said originally, little if any meaningful prosecution. And we have a lot of civil litigation, much of which is not successful on behalf of those being abused. And it becomes very much a public issue. It's like they're trying to build a public forum on this, which sometimes can be effective. And everybody's waiting for the meaningful, what's the fulcrum point with Scientology to take it down or to do this. And it's sort of like waiting for disclosure on UFOs.
Yeah.
It never happened because it's maybe the people have other lessons to learn besides that. It's, in any case, it's all a very unfortunate situation because many of these people have suffered, and correcting the injustice
sometimes is more challenging than taking the punishment that they originally took.
Right.
So it's like, wow, I'm trying, and then the justice system is not perfect. It's far from perfect and often moves in reverse direction. But what I was going to say is, or what I did say is that this is it ends up as a negative feeding frenzy where people trying to get pedestrian justice are not going to get pedestrian justice because it's not a pedestrian issue. And
what do you mean by that?
Well, you're dealing with occult forces. You're dealing with occult forces that have taken advantage of people.
Right.
So even one of the most landmark cases where Scientology lost was a guy named Lawrence Wallersheim, who I knew. It took him like 22, 23 years to conduct his case and get a payment. And when he got, as part of that payment, it was like, it took him 8 years to collect the payment after he went through all these trials and tribulations because the church wouldn't pay him. And all this interest to collect it, it went up from 2 point something million to about $8 million, $8 million and change. And because they wouldn't pay the interest on it. So he had to, it took him 8 years to execute the law so he could get this money. You see, and the lesson there was, is it worth 23 years of your life to fight Scientology? You see?
Yeah.
And now whether this is right or not is really not the point. Certainly it's not, if he did win the case and he was rightfully entitled to X amount of money, he certainly... It shouldn't take him 23 years to collect it. And this is the problem. So people can have spent the huge portion of their long adult lives fighting this element. And sometimes you need to embrace the Taoist principle of fighting without fighting. And, you know, is it worth it to you to consume your energy so it becomes an energy consumption issue,
right?
And it breeds herd mentality where everybody's feeding on this herd mentality on either side of Scientology. The Scientologists are herding, or they're being like a herd, and so are the ex-Scientologists, the people fighting it. It becomes a herd mentality, and neither of these service the individuals involved, in my opinion. But that's their own personal decision, and life expresses itself in many, many forms. So we were talking about this occult matrix, this occult issue, and I said I would approach this. The only thing I'm going to say is that the most controversial part of Scientology is their upper levels, which have been ridiculed on South Park and ridiculed ad nauseum elsewhere in the media, on television, and broadcasting of all sorts. But the interesting thing is, it's about being consumed by clusters of negative energy. And the people involved, in my opinion, in both Scientology and in the anti-movement are consuming themselves in the very phenomena of which they're either denying, on the half of the Scientologists, denying that this is our upper-level information, or might be involved in, and then the people who decry it, they're actually patterning their lives as being a part of the phenomena, or they're mimicking the phenomena that they say doesn't exist, or
right.
They're decrying, and it's just...
Well, South Park was my introduction to Scientology.
Well, There you go. It's a charged subject. But what's more important than any of this raucous noise that doesn't really, in my opinion, lead to solutions. It's like post-traumatic stress disorder. It just stays in a general realm of hysteria, or I don't know if hysteria is the right word, but unresolved emotional trauma for the people involved. And they've got to do something with their trauma. They have to process it one way or another, and fighting back is one way people choose. Whether it's the best way or not, it's an individual choice.
Right. But it can be very frustrating, that's for sure.
Well, yes, and you can spend your whole life in frustration if you want.
Yeah.
Or you can look at alternatives, and how are you going to spend the next 5 years of your life? Are you going to fight something and never win? Or are you going to...
I see what you're saying. I mean, it can be just so tiresome. I think some of the things I'm curious about, and like you said earlier, when we first started talking, you know, what are you going to do with all the information once you have it? And that, you know, that's a great point. I don't know.
Well, I'm going to tell you, there's a very big joke with regard to Scientology. And as I had, I don't know if we lost this information or not, but one author had said that L. Ron Hubbard was initiated in the level of the fool in occultism, the fool. And the fool does not care what happens.
Right.
So when you have the fool in the tarot card, you see the fool and he's right on the edge of the cliff and he doesn't care whether he falls or whatnot. And then he's got, depending on which card you see, a tiger or a dog yapping at his feet. And he doesn't care that the dog is yapping at him. Well, all these anti-Scientologists have put themselves in the position of the yapping dog, you see?
Yeah.
Because the fool doesn't care. Now, whether or not L. Ron Hubbard accepted this initiation in the fool or did it is kind of, he was well aware of that principle, and he did act in that way, in my opinion. But it's like, you know, they're not going to do anything to him. He's passed away. And he's not going to be being bitten at by this dog. And so the dog bites. Do you want to be a dog that's biting at what? Or a tiger that's biting? And just trying to, this is only a part of the joke. The one of the most controversial issues that upset a lot of, I guess what I'd say, ex-Scientologists, they weren't really ex-Scientologists, they were independent Scientology, because there's the ex-Scientologist, there's the Scientologist, and then there's the independent Scientologist who advocate Scientology, but not doing it, but they don't advocate the way the church does it. They advocate doing it in an independent means, as they would say that L. Ron Hubbard wanted it to be done.
Mm-hmm.
So, one of the, this, I think this really upset, or certainly put a highly charged response into a lot of people, was that there was this issue that came out and was posted on the internet where L. Ron Hubbard, it's upper level procedure, and when he talks about that he needs a lot of people to finish this level so that they can help him reincarnate, where he's going to come back as a politician. He's going to come back as a politician and he's going to be identified with the beast. He says, you know, Revelation, what you read of Revelation is, you know, essentially this part's true that, you know, the beast, and he's going to come back as the beast.
Right.
Now, when I saw this, I thought it was the most ludicrous thing I'd ever read, at least attributed to him, because I didn't believe that it was him. Although it was written in his vernacular. The first thing is, because when I did the upper levels of Scientology, there was a very specific statement that said, if you see future levels that are not in my handwriting, they're not mine. It would always come out in his handwriting.
Huh.
Well, this level was never in his handwriting. We've never seen it in his handwriting. And many of the independent Scientologists refuted that it had anything to do, that it was never a part, that it was not by L. Ron Hubbard. They'd all even established that it had nothing to do with L. Ron Hubbard. It had been established. Well, I knew that it had been part of a court case because I talked to the man who brought it up in a court case. He actually sued Scientology so they would do correct Scientology procedures. Now, he forfeited any interest he had in Scientology, not only with that lawsuit, but he lost interest. He was horribly upset about what had gone on. But this sort of established beyond the shadow of a doubt that it was a part of the curriculum. So some people said it wasn't part of the curriculum. I think they've taken it off the curriculum of Scientology, the upper levels. I think they've taken it off. But at one point it was on.
The part that...
About this beast of revelation.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
And this is the big joke. Because, you know, that what I read in that, and there's a lot more grisly stuff in it that I'm not going to even try to remember. But the point of it was that it did sound like his vernacular, and I have to, as far as the information I have seen so far, think that he probably did write it because he, by all information, degenerated as he got older. And he did not, but whether... the whole thing, why this is a joke, and on the assumption that he did indeed write it, is because this is totally inconsistent with anything that I would have read or studied from him, that he would have been saying such a thing. Not completely, but mostly inconsistent. Because he did joke about being the Prince of Darkness in one of his tapes and referred to Aleister Crowley as his good friend. However, he is basically positioning himself as the beast of the apocalypse. And while that's a pretty heady thing to identify yourself with, it makes a lot of sense in a comical, joking sort of way, but it goes back to the question you asked me on our second podcast, and this had to do with the apocalypse.
Right.
And the apocalypse is, as I explained to you, the word actually means the uncovering of the goddess. But in the traditional acceptance of the idea of an apocalypse, it has to do with the Bible, it has to do with the opening of the seventh seal, and it has to do with when all hell breaks loose and... a chasm opens up between the Mount of Olives and the Temple of Solomon, and the final battle takes place, and all the herd of, I guess, spirits flock to Satan or the Antichrist, or they flock to Christ, and it's all very dramatic.
Yeah.
And this is almost a cartoon interpretation of the apocalypse. And the apocalypse is just an idea of ultimate revelation. Now, because L. Ron Hubbard was operating in an occult matrix underneath and before he got involved in Scientology, and he was carrying that occult matrix for a long time, probably, I believe he was carrying it in his DNA, he played an interesting role, not only in a very interesting role in my life, but he's played an interesting role in the human drama that we know as life in the what's now the 21st century. Now, a big element of what he was doing with his work with Jack Parsons and the Babylon Working was he was trying to emulate what John Dee and Edward Kelly were doing back in the 1500s. And so there was a relationship between Parsons and Hubbard and Crowley and Dee. And in magical work, sympathetic resonance is a very important point. So Kelly was the one who channeled the Enochian language. He did it meticulously. Edward Kelly was known as a con man. He was known as a con man, a trickster, but he was also had a reputation for being able to transmute base metals into gold. And he also literally did create this angelic language.
Wait, go back. He was able to...
He was
an alchemist?
He had a reputation in Bohemia for transmuting base metals into gold.
Wow.
Now, how successful he was, I can't say, but he had a reputation for actually being able to do it. That's a whole other subject.
Yeah.
But John Dee was, I guess, what you call the responsible one of the two. And they were doing this whole work. Now, Parsons and Hubbard were emulating this work. And I know this because you'll not only see it in Parsons' writing, Marjorie Cameron told me this very specifically. It was the first time John Dee struck a chord in my consciousness was when she told me about the John Dee element. Now, people call L. Ron Hubbard a con man. They also called Edward Kelly a con man. But Edward Kelly actually delivered something. Now, whether it's good or bad is beyond the point. He delivered a highly complex Enochian language and system that can be used to access the angelic realm. And when I say angelic, you say angelic slash demon realm.
Okay.
And all I'm saying is Hubbard was able to access certain pieces of consciousness and access certain keys and also make them accessible to people. So whether or not the con man, some people's eyes, he most definitely is, you can't throw out all the information with what is either the con or the alleged con. So, and this goes back to Edward Kelly, but the important point here is that John Dee and Edward Kelly were doing all of their work based upon a sigil called the Sigil De'Amath, or the Sigil of Truth. And this sigil was based on an earlier sigil that went back to about the earliest recording that I know of is around 300 AD, and it was a Holy Roman Emperor. I think he's a Roman Emperor, but it was after Constantine. I believe he was after Constantine. I think it was Honorarius was his name. But anyway, this was a sigil that evolved or was developed in time and
what does sigil mean?
It's just a symbol. It's a symbol with significant symbols on it and whatnot. Now, this sigil...
Oh, are you saying symbol or sigil?
Sigil. S-I-G-I-L.
Okay.
Sigil.
Okay.
And it's got an import to it. Now, this is a very complex sigil, if you ever look at it, and it's filled with heptagons and... It's got a pentagram in the middle, and it's got a big round, I want to call it a dial, but around the circumference there's letters and numbers. Now, this was all given to them by the angels. Now, this was to complete earlier sigils. It was to complete. And it's completely color-coded. And if you read it in certain ways under certain complicated circumstances, which I'm not going to try to describe right now, you would see the name of angels. And you could invoke angels by calling their names and whatnot. And when Dee and Kelly, they had this sigil, and they had it right on the front of their table, and they had a crystal ball in the middle of it. And if you look through the crystal ball, you could read the names of the angels, and you could see the geometric contortions that it was conducive to helping you read the actual sigil. But there was also, and this was made of wax, there were other sigils put under each leg of the table. So the sigil itself was like a talisman to gate in the angels. So it was And what Dee's rationale in all of this was, is that John Dee had a intellectual education. He was brought up in the court of the king or the queen, whoever it was at the time. And he had a royal education. But he was so smart that he learned everything there was about science in his day. So he wanted to take it one step beyond, because science could only take him so far. In other words, instead of being a pedestrian journalist, he was a pedestrian scientist. And he said, I'm going for more here. And he did go for more. And he did get more. And this goes far deeper still, and we're only going to present it where the paradigm is in this. And as I say, it presents like a big joke with Scientology when Hubbard either did or allegedly promotes himself as the beast of revelation. Because John Dee's rationale was that when doing all of this work, he wanted to go back literally before the fall from grace and get back into the unity consciousness that existed prior to the fall from grace. And when I say fall from grace, I'm referring to Adam and Eve okay. Falling from the Garden of Eden. That's the fall from grace, where men stood in a graceful position with the Creator, and then he ate from the tree of good and evil, the knowledge of good and evil, and so we have here a paradigm. Now, this sigil is very important because this was mentioned in the book, The Seventh Seal, the sigil. But this sigil, the deconstruction of it and the true understanding of it represents the apocalypse. And this is according to magicians most everywhere. And this sigil has been studied ad nauseum by people. And the only, and a lot of, I guess what you'd say, conscientious work has gone into understanding it. There's some very interesting videos, YouTubes you can watch on it, by Jonathan Gee. But even then, he doesn't have all the answers.
Right.
He can show you some of the intricacies of it. And it's much more deeply ingrained and rooted into our culture and consciousness than people would understand. But the point I'm making here is that this magical construct represents the way our whole world is tied together, the way it's all leads from all these different tentacles. It's a metaphor for what holds this existence together. And John Dee utilized it to work magic, to understand things, to commune with the angels and whatnot. So, Hubbard...
Have you ever seen anybody do that?
Have I watched...
Commune with the angels?
Not using this sigil, per se.
Okay.
There have been actually scientific observations of it being done by somebody who was a raw scientist that watched it done. And this created a lot of cacophony in the academic world, in this specific academic situation. They weren't able to use the auditorium anymore.
Really?
Yeah, but I will go into more of that in the next podcast.
Okay.
But the point I'm saying here is this is the great revelation, so to speak. Now, whether or not, and to me this indicates that Hubbard actually did say this, and he did write it, because it's almost like it makes it come full circle. when I first read it, I thought, this is the biggest bunch of hogwash I've ever read.
Yeah.
And because, number one, I didn't think he wrote it. And I didn't think he could be what I thought to be that stupid to write it. But now when I look at it, it's almost like some part of his psyche is saying this stuff because there's a harmonic of truth in it, and it's almost like he has to identify himself with this dark side of himself. And I do not consider the man to be all dark, any way, shape, or form.
Right.
But he did have a dark side, and this is the dark side coming through and saying, you know, I'm the beast of Revelation, and is all this attention going to be put on me, or to in order to accomplish the ultimate revelation of for or on behalf of mankind? Now,
that's a little arrogant, isn't it?
No. I'm not speaking of a point of arrogance here. I'm speaking.
Hubbard.
I'm not speaking of a point of him being arrogant.
No.
I'm saying is there's a part of him that this was what he had to deliver to us.
Yeah.
In other words, to say you're the beast is not a very arrogant statement. It's a statement of it's not arrogance to me. It might be crazy. It might be mad.
It's not arrogance.
It's anybody saying he's the beast is the beast, at least to a degree.
Right.
To a degree. He's rooting for that. But what I'm saying is, I think the reason he said it's almost like he is a catalyst to revelation. And the revelation is of what I'm alluding to here. There's a bigger picture here.
Right.
All the magical work that he did and all the Scientology work that he did has led us to this, you know, sputtering wind-up toy that's going around and it comes out and says, you know, I'm the beast, I'm the beast, I'm the beast, I'm the beast, you know, and it's like, okay, you're the beast.
Yeah.
Well, good for you.
Congratulations.
Now we can look at this paradigm because the whole part of this sigil is that the deciphering of it, the understanding of it is literally the apocalypse. Now, if you think of the word apocalypse from a typical sort of program interpretation, you think of all, you know, the world going to hell in a handbag. If you think of it in terms of the apocalypse, what I said being the revelation or the uncovering of the goddess, you have a whole wave of energy coming into the earth that is going to be more like a mother. Now, a mother can be ruthless, and it doesn't mean it's all happy,
right,
pick the baby up and suckle it and feed it. No, it doesn't mean that. But it definitely represents a new current, and the deciphering of this sigil what it represents metaphorically is the complete unraveling of this existence and these constructs as we know it. It's deconstructing time. And one of the angels even said to John Dee, you know, we make time, we move time. I'm paraphrasing him.
Mm-hmm.
We don't move for time, we move time. So basically, right as I'm studying this sigil, and the only reason I'm studying this sigil is because I'm doing a reprint of the book Seventh Seal, Synchronicity in the Seventh Seal, and it addresses this sigil. So I started rereading what I had written about the sigil, and right in the midst of that, David Anderson had emailed me and says, yes, I'd like to do a podcast with you.
Yeah.
So he represents the deconstruction of time as we know it, at least in my mind he does.
Right.
So this is at least the second, it's not the second time. He's come into my life on once before Well, in magical reference frames that reference to magic. I'm not going to go into those. So for him to kind of just give a shout out to me at that exact time was not insignificant because
kind of out of the blue.
It was out of the blue because I'd written to him over a month earlier.
Right.
After having spoken to him. And I didn't hear back, and he says, I try to keep away from emails and communications of any kind, while he's doing his work. So basically, we have that podcast to look forward to, but it all represents the unraveling of space and time as we know it. And as I say this to you, the pragmatic side to me says, the more things change, the more they stay the same. Do I think that everybody's going to understand this? I don't know. There's a lot of people who aren't suited to understand much of anything on this planet.
That's true.
So it's not necessarily that everybody's going to experience revelation on any level without any reference to any religion. It's like, what is your experience? So as we're moving through the times, and I am, for better or for worse, an interpreter of the times, along with many other people that exist with me on this earth who iterate, rather through writing, broadcasting, or however, we're all interpreters of the times. So times are changing, and this sigil is on the horizon of consciousness, and it always has been, because there are a lot of magicians who study this, and you can look at them on YouTube, and you can see them giving their insights into it, for better or for worse. Mm-hmm. But all of them, and some of them have done really studious work, and sometimes that can get them into trouble because they can lose the forest from the trees. But nevertheless, many people have worked hard on this, and they understand a lot of the history that went into it, but none of them have either solved the question or solved the riddle it represents. And the way I solved the riddle when I first encountered it was to bypass it and to say, well, this is good, it's interesting, but it's not the way to resolve much of anything ultimately. And while that was, when I go back and I reread it, I get further insights into it, and it causes me to look into it. I've never been attached to it, except in the last week or so when I've been, reviewing it and looking at different information. So this sigil is the magical construct upon which the British Empire was based. We can say that very conservatively. And the British Empire rules the world to this day.
Yes.
It doesn't rule it utterly and completely. It's the most influential political structure in the world. And this is, John Dee was the one who coined the word Rule Britannia. And the modus operandi of Rule Britannia is to go into a country like the United States, economically control it, win the War of 1812, and make the United States think they won it, and have all the financial advantages of having won that war, which the United States thinks it won. And we're basically, independent, but we're not independent.
Right.
They have the most extensive and clever intelligence network in the world. They set up our intelligence network here. They wrote the whole, it was Ian Fleming, the author of the James Bond stories, who wrote the whole setup for the OSS, and of which the CIA was patterned after. And they control all sorts of things. And, of course, he was a big student of John Dee, Ian Fleming.
Right.
So we're no longer dealing in pedestrian anything.
And you reminded me of Tom Clancy as well, died a couple of years ago. And he was always a pedestrian journalist in the movies that he made and the storylines. And I just found it curious that he passed away a couple of years, and I was always curious about what he was actually working on at the time.
I really don't know.
Yeah.
what he was working on. But there's a lot of, you know, he whatever he was, and I never read his works, he was an interpreter of the times.
Yeah.
And that's what everybody is. We're all interpreters of the times. Some of us are better at it than others. And so anyway, this is sort of where, and to, when I did hear, I guess he's a remote viewer of some notoriety. One of the first, I one time heard him give a talk, and the first thing he talked about was John Dee and Edward Kelly and how the whole intelligence apparatus was based upon what they did. Now, this was a so-called bona fide remote viewer.
Okay.
He was not very interesting, but he did know this about, you know, because he came right out of the intelligence community and the remote viewing community. And he was talking all about John Dee and Edward Kelly and how they set up the initial spy network that became the MI5, MI6. And of course, so that there is, this is very much a part of the remote viewing culture and the underpinnings of the remote viewing issues that we're dealing with. So when we come back, we'll address this sigil once again, and we're going to talk about some of the underlying fabric of magic.